That's where Rachel's family is from.
Rachel
Greenfield Don. That's her maiden
name.
Rachel Don.
Rachel Don.
That's her married name.
Greenfield.
You know what?
She went to Akiba. She.
So our my older daughter went to. Well, then it was called. It's been called Barrack now.
Yeah.
My younger daughter went to Lorraine.
Her stepfather is Morton Klein. Okay.
So my friend was the PR person for Barrack.
Really?
Bev Rosen.
I know the name, yeah.
Yeah.
And Wendy's from Philadelphia as well.
Right,
anybody else?
I'm actually from New York, I have to say that.
I'm going to Philadelphia for
we'll bring back pretzels.
I'm going for Bormitt. And what's funny is that the cousins that Lynn's going to for Thanksgiving are friends of the parents of the bar mitzvah that we just figured that out.
Oh my goodness. Oh my goodness.
I mean, talk about there are only three Jews in the world.
That's true.
Small world. I mean, she hears the name and she says, I know that name.
Oh, wait, let me just put this down. Okay, so while we're not quite starting yet, Taste of Limud is Thursday night. Aaron Edelheit, author of The Hard Break, Case for 24/6 Lifestyle. And then we have Rabbi Alush, Rabbi Coppell, Rabbi Schneider as the second part. So we have him as the Aaron Edelheit as the keynote, and then these breakout sessions. And it's been great. So I highly recommend this. And this is your pre-full day, your taste of what the full day might be like. And it should be great. So come if you can. And let me just put that off, and now that is off. Excellente.
You mean it's going to be November 15th already on Thursday?
Yes.
No, I know.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, November goes quickly.
I'm still in October.
It's going to happen to September. What happened to February?
February goes really quickly.
Right now it's almost end of the year.
Yeah. No, it's.
Yesterday I was at the women's symposium.
Oh, I heard it was great.
I thought so too. But the woman got up to sing God Bless America. And she said, and then we'll do Kol Nidre. She made a mistake, but it was so funny.
So funny. Yeah. Well,
no national anthem.
We were listening to somebody last night who already has the Pesach plans all planned out. It's not even like close. Ilana Storch. Ilana? That's you. So Ilana and Ruth Cylon also is not here today, and my mom, but this won't be good.
Barry.
I'll have to give her. And Barry should be here. I have a meeting with her, so she should. She didn't say she wasn't coming.
Someone's walking.
There's Barry. There's Barry. So we'll just wait.
I put myself on the airplane and I show up.
Those are my plans.
Yeah, my son says you do this with this child and you do this with that child and you do
this. It's Barry.
And then I can put the dishes in the dishwasher. And I clean up.
It's
really quite nice.
Okay, so we will get the show on the road. So here's this amazing story. But before we begin this amazing story, this is an interview with Deborah Eisenberg from something called Art Beats, which I'm not familiar with. But she says some things in here about children, which I think are really, really important. So we'll just go around and read it. Sorry for the funny colors. I don't even know why that is, but okay. How do you begin to structure or write your stories? It's kind of hard to say because it's not exactly a process that I arrived at in any conscious way. It takes me a very, very long time to write a story, to write a piece of fiction, whatever you call the fiction that I write. I just go about it blindly, feeling my way towards what it has to be. We've heard this before from a number of authors. Things undergo many, many revisions. So I don't make a conscious decision that, oh, this is the effect that I want. I slowly, slowly, slowly go about making something the way that it insists on being made. And that's why, you know, every single word. She says it takes her a year to write a short story.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a long time. Okay. Fran, do you want to keep going?
Do you think that a distinctly different process than writing a novel, I don't think that it would probably be different in my case. I think it's probably just the way I write. Although, I think that what we're both implying, you in your question and me in my response, is that I don't start with an outline of events, because I don't really consider events in themselves to reveal anything. They very rarely do. And I'm not interested in just this happened, that happened, then the next thing happened. And I suppose most novels, to generalize, depend on a very, what's that word?
Propulsive
plot line. Obviously, that's not always true.
Okay, so a propulsive plot line. That's so interesting, because we think of a story as a, you know, a narrative that tells you, I don't know, some kind of linear progression in time. But that's not what she's interested in at all. No plot. I mean, there sometimes there's a little hint of a plot, but not much. And the other thing, the plot. Okay, Harriet?
A lot of times you include children or younger people in your stories who have a clarity of perspective. Could you discuss that a little? I include children because sometimes they need to be in the story. They need to be in the piece. It's always nice to have minds that are unclouded by cliché. I suppose I'm always looking for a sort of acuity of perception, either in my characters or about my characters. And there's a sort of loneliness, maybe that children sometimes possess, that provides a very useful way of looking at things.
Right. So unclouded by cliché. And that's the amazing thing about, you know, sometimes when we're with children and they see something and you realize they're seeing, when we see it through their eyes, we're seeing it new again. Mm-hmm. Because they're not coming at it necessarily with, a sort of predefined reaction to something. It's a sharpness of perception. Okay, and now, Lois, do you want to keep going?
The child characters you've created, they have an understanding of moral terrain. Oh, I definitely believe that. I think the children are acutely sensitive to injustice because they live in a world that is absolutely filled with injustice. They have a very, very little power, and they are extremely aware of power relations. So children are experts at manipulation, and others are experts at discerning and weighing all manner of injustices, and are extremely empathetic. It may be there's a kind of empathy that broadens or deepens in adulthood, but heaven knows children experience enormous compassion. I mean, many children do, and I think they are extremely aware of moral issues.
So I thought that's such an interesting perspective. Acutely sensitive to injustice because they live in a world that is absolutely filled with injustice. What does she mean by that?
She's talking about kids today.
Kids all the time. Kids all the time.
So many restrictions on children.
And they don't have the power.
And they have no say.
Right. They don't have as much say.
They have no say. And there are things, you know, there are things that are really... we're born into the family we're born in, and it's not fair, you know? There's, you know, if we're lucky, the amount of injustice, because things don't make sense to us as children. And so even if there's a sense to it, and there's, you know, and it's important, it doesn't seem just. And so, you know, so they know that there's a lot wrong with the world because of their lack of power.
How do we always see hear kids saying, that's not fair?
Right. Uh-huh. You're not the boss of me?
Yeah.
And, right.
Yeah.
And the answer, that's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
yeah.
I also think that they have been taught, most children have been taught, it's this or it's that. And then when we deviate a little bit, to them you're messing up their parameters that they have seen as being established.
Thinkers. Black and white.
They're concrete thinkers at a young age.
Only to a certain point. I mean, one of our favorite family stories is our younger son's fourth birthday when his cousin and his brother wanted to play with this new toy, and his answer was tomorrow. And his older brother said, but that's not fair. I always let you play with new toys on my birthday, which is true. And the four-year-old answered, but Aaron, we don't live in a fair world. I told you tomorrow. Okay? And many, many, many children, before they become, when they're still in a very concrete stage, when they don't have a lot of moral development, have already learned that lesson. And they've internalized it, and when it was pointed out to the, I guess he was 25, because it was pointed out to his four-year-old cousin and his six-year-old brother that, you know, what does fairness have to do with this situation? They accepted it immediately, and so we let the kids handle this.
Yeah.
I mean, they already, by ages 4, 5, and 6, knew how to deal with the situation that wasn't fair. It was discussed, and it was his new toy.
Yeah.
And he set the parameters. Mm-hmm. I mean, children know these things.
They inherently know. Yeah.
Who will treat them with fairness and who won't.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things, I mean, I love to watch some of the young parents in our shul, because we have some of them who are just spectacular. You know, I wish I was that kind of parent. But one of the things that they do is they educate their children for agency. In other words, they give their children as much independence as the kids can handle, which is a lot more than most parents think that kids can handle. Kids can handle a tremendous amount. And it makes the kids feel like they have a tiny bit of control. You see what it does to them. You know, their whole self is like, I can do this, and I can do this, and I can do this. It's such an interesting thing to think of, you know, if you know, when I have the other, you know, when I have it to do over again with my kids, right? You know, just being thinking about that. And this is what, you know, Piaget, the great, you know, his idea is that the goal of all education is autonomy, and it's self, you know, self-government or self-discipline and that kind of thing. And that's because that autonomy is agency. And so, you know, and so what you know, so really terrific parents, at least from what I've seen here recently, this idea of total helplessness in the face of powerlessness, which is what this injustice can seem like, you know, there's a way of mitigating that if you're, you know, if you're thoughtful, intentional about it.
I think of the voice of the narrator in our story who had almost no agency as a kid, right?
Yes.
When I was a little kid, my father died when I was very young, and my uncle, one of my uncles wanted to do something, he didn't know what to do, and he entered me in this contest and I won a TV set. And we had a little bitty TV set, and this was a big TV set. And I was like 5. And so I felt, because it was mine, I controlled who could watch and how much they could watch. And it was amazing because they were remarkably tolerant of me, which I was really pretty obnoxious about it. But my mother was waiting for the TV to break. And then she said, okay, you're done. She said, unless you can pay to repair it, you no longer have control over the TV set.
Interesting.
And so they just all waited till, because they knew, because TVs broke a lot in those days.
Right.
Well,
right.
They just waited. The tubes burned out.
Right, right. So they just waited for my reign to be over.
I went to someone's home for dinner. I was invited, and they have, right now, 4 children waiting for the 5th. The little boy took me out to see his chickens that he took care of. Then they were making dinner. They were all making dinner. and he was cutting something with a knife. I think he was four then.
Oh.
I have to tell you, these are the most amazing children. You know exactly who I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm. Indeed, that's who I was talking about.
Absolutely amazing. And they all do everything together. They all made the dinner. And the father taught them how to tie the chicken with the, you know, with the string. Mm-hmm. And if I ever have to, if I ever have the opportunity to redo, that's what I would do. The first time I saw these people, the first time they came to Shul, I saw this woman sitting at a small table with her four children at the time, and the, and an infant, and I never saw children so quiet and well-behaved and eating their meal. I had to go over to her and say, you're amazing.
Yeah.
And so you know.
Yeah.
What I'm
so,
saying.
Yeah.
They had their, they had the power to do everything.
Right. Right. And so, but this is so applicable to, you know, our narrator and the way that she's, and how we see the world through her eyes, which is just heartbreaking. Okay, revision. Wendy?
How do you go about a revision, structuring a scene, or the inclusion of these sorts of details? How do you envision what your characters are doing? Well, again, it's not really a conscious process. Often I'll have a scene of people having a conversation in a room, then it turns out it's either the wrong people or the wrong room, and I just have to keep going about it until I find the right people in the right room. It's true that I'm oftentimes dealing with a crowd, and that's extremely inconvenient for a writer, but there's nothing I can do about
it. Okay. Ina, do you want to keep going?
Do you follow the news closely, or are you wary of researching fiction that way? In certain ways, I'm not at all what people mean by political, but I have different biases of temperament. And like it or not, we live in a world that has been very much imposed upon by events, global events and local events. And like it or not, we are residents of a, and citizens of a country that has been disproportionate, has disproportionate power in the world. As you and I are merely talking on the phone, heaven knows what many people, how many people are being killed all over the world with our money. Mm-hmm. And it's not just possible to be unaware of that all the time. I came into my adulthood during the Vietnam War, so it's sort of a shadow over one's mind all the time. I'm saying it in a way, I suppose, that as hard as it might be, it might, as it might try to be a completely private person, it's out of the question at this moment for those of us who live in the U.S., both in reality and in our consciousness.
Both in reality and in our consciousness, yeah. So, you know, it's such an interesting way of, yes, she's saying politics do intrude onto my writing, but not because I'm bringing them in. It's just simply these are the factors mm-hmm. that I'm working with. I work with the factors that I have, and I keep going until I get it right, you know, which is which explains why a year to write mm-hmm. a short story. Okay, and lastly.
Do you think that artists deal with these issues? Do you think that artists have any kind of responsibility to chronicle them and discuss them? I say, and this is something that if you catch me in a half hour, I'll say something completely different. But as you're asking me right this minute, I say that I think that the responsibility that artists have, if we can speak of such a thing, is to be truthful. Mm-hmm. And that might mean just about anything. A politicized world is sort of devouring us, but in a way I think that artists must be very, very free in their minds. And if what absorbs their attention is their toenails, that's what they should expend the effort on contemplating. But the world filters into the mind, and you can't do anything about it.
And I just want to say one thing about that. responsibility that artists have is to be truthful. Many, many years ago, I had to testify in a court case as a character witness. And as a character witness, they only allow you to say what you've heard about the person, not what you know about the person, but what you've heard about the person. And I came out of that experience. The prosecutor wanted to, like, cut me down. So she says, "Rabbi, is it?" You know, it's like, okay, we know what we're dealing with. But what it was, you know, if I said something, you know, like sort of very literally saying what happened, that wouldn't tell about this guy's character, you know? So it's like I had to think about, like, how do you get the truth out, you know, when you, and so this idea of how you get the truth out if, you know, certain words, even if they're true words, they will not convey the truth of who the person is, what the situation is. It's a very interesting, difficult question, you know. When she says our responsibility is to be truthful, that's a huge burden, you know, because it's not just that I'm writing true words, it's that my words have to convey, you know, the truth as I experience it. And that's bigger than just correct words, a lot bigger.
We also get the feeling she's massaging every word.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so we're not going to do the whole thing this week. We're going to do part of it next week. What we're going to do this week is look at, you know, the one of the main themes of the story, which is this mother-daughter relationship. So what we'll leave for next week is memory and language and a couple of other things. I mean, it'll come in as we're going through it, but okay, cross off and move on. Tell me about the title. What do we learn from the title? Or what don't we learn from the title? Yes?
Yeah. My father used to say, you learn from your mistakes, you figure out what you did wrong, and you move on, and you don't go back and revisit it.
Mm-hmm. So great strategy, right? Let's not totally relive the past, because we can be stuck in the past. And yet, on the other hand,
you don't do either. Yeah. You just don't.
You don't do either.
Yeah, you don't cross anything off, and you don't move on.
The past is never the past. The past is always with us. So the idea of I'll cross off that experience and I'll move on. Yes, to a certain extent I will, but it doesn't mean that I don't take with me what I just crossed off. It doesn't, you know, and this is one of the themes of all of the stories that we've seen so far, which is, you know, that I'm over and done with it.
Yeah.
Okay. And, you know, right, over and done with it. You know, these things come with us, and so it, you know, it makes for something a little more complicated. So,
Lana, it goes back to that in the very first story. Mm-hmm. The same point I brought up before, when it's as though you exchange something with it. It keeps a little bit of you, and you keep a little bit of it. I know, he said, and the thing you mostly get to keep is leaving.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Right. Okay,
I mean,
beautiful. Yes, mm-hmm. Right. The most thing you get to keep is leaving. You leave the experience, but, you know, you keep a little bit of it. It keeps a little bit of you.
Well,
yeah,
you,
beautiful.
You know what you've learned.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
If you don't acknowledge what you've learned, then, but you've learned it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If you have squeezed out the blessing of the situation, you've learned it. Otherwise, you can just go on oblivious, you know. But even then, there are parts of the experience that go with you. So if you don't learn from it, you're really missing the opportunity, because it's with you anyway. Okay, Adela, Bernice, and Charna, the youngest.
ABC.
I know.
All gone for a long time now, blurred into a flock sailing through memory, their long, thin legs streaming out beneath the fluffy domes of their mangy fur coats. Is it Mangy?
Mangy.
Mangy.
It's not a very positive word.
Their great beaky noses pointing the way. Okay. Well, actually, I'll keep going just one more. They come to mind not so often. They come to mind only as often as does my mother, whose rancor toward them, my father's sisters, imbued them with a certain luster and has linked them to her permanently in the distant and shadowy arena of my childhood that now, given the obit in today's times of violinist Maura Sandler, provides most of the space all four of them still occupy on this planet. It's an amazing sentence. that sentence is four lines long. That's and it's not a run-on. It's a beautifully constructed sentence. Okay, so what have we learned so far about the aunts and about the mom?
They're the aunts, and then there's the mom.
Okay, so these are two distinct camps, right?
But the mother's feelings about the aunts have made them far more important than they might have been otherwise.
Right. They have gained a luster. Right. Yeah. Okay. What's the first thing that we learn about the mom?
Rancor.
The very first thing about this woman is rancor. I guess more correctly you would say is she has a daughter who doesn't think about her all that much. Thinks of her from time to time. And when she does, it's together with the aunts. So what about that first sentence about the aunts?
You can almost picture them. Mm-hmm. It's almost like a caricature.
Bird-like structures.
So they have these beaky...
Long Jewish noses.
These beaky noses.
Much later in the story, where her mother doesn't have nice legs, and the aunts all have nice legs, and the mother makes fun of the noses.
Right, they have the noses, right, and she doesn't, and her claim to fame is that she has a nice nose, as opposed to her daughter, who has their nose.
And it's ABC. They're always a flock. Yeah. These are not individuals. I mean, this is, it was almost like, you know, when you see the birds lined up, and one's in the front, and then the two are behind, and then, you know, I mean, it's almost like this vision of, they're a unity, as opposed to individuals.
This first sentence is sailing through memory, because that's all the space that they occupy on this earth is memory, mm-hmm. right? They are not here, neither is the mom. The space, because the arena of my childhood provides most of the space of all four of them that all four of them still occupy on this planet. So this is looking back. I mean, she'll go into her persona as a child, but at least this beginning, all gone for a long time now. So this is memory, blurred into a flock sailing through. And so there's this something about memory that, you know, that things can sort of fly through and they're a little bit elusive. You know, we try to get a grasp on them, and sometimes we do, but sometimes there's, just like the house, which is, we'll see, is there's something mysterious about it, or there's something there are, let's say, corners of the experience which you can't make out. It's there's something coming in there, but it's hard to discern. And so one of the things she'll deal with is the nature of memory. So here come the aunts, and with the aunts come the mother. And the mother, you know, is rancor, and they're a little bit brighter because of the rancor. And the thing that's bringing all of this to the fore is cousin Maury, who has just died. Fran, do you want to keep going?
Sure. But I do want to say
that
the only way she found out about his death was through an obituary. There was nobody else in the family to contact her, it appears.
Yes.
I was preparing to eat. I plunked an omelet onto a plate, sat down in front of it, folded the paper in such a way that I could maneuver my fork between my supper and my mouth, and still read, and fetched Cousin Maury's picture staring at me.
Okay, so we can exactly picture it, right? Mm-hmm. You know, the paper's here, the fork's here between me and, you know, so I could maneuver the omelet into my mouth. What a great description. Yep. Okay. And up fetched Cousin Maury's picture, as if Cousin Maury's picture just appeared. Yeah.
So,
God bless you.
Thank you.
Sneeze at the truth. Okay. Of course, I didn't exactly recognize Maury, and if I hadn't glanced at the photo again and been snagged by the small headline, I might have gone on for years, assuming that my only known remaining relative was out there somewhere.
Okay.
The tethers.
So, just hold on one second. So, I might have gone on for years, assuming that my only known remaining relative was out there somewhere. As if that would make a difference. You know, they're not in touch, but I could have gone on thinking that he was alive. Okay. Harriet, do you want to keep going?
The tether snapped and I shot upward, wafting around for a moment outside of Earth's gravitational pull, and then dropped heavily back down into my chair next to my supper, cracks branching violently through my equanimity, from which my family, such as it was, came seeping.
Okay, let's stop there, because it's another amazing sentence. Yeah. What's going on there?
Well, everything was so vague, ethereal, not out there. And then with this obit picture, the tether snapped, and she is up there a little bit, and then plunked down into reality, where her family and the memories and all that stuff, she's faced with it.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Branching violently through my equanimity.
Well, she had crossed it off and moved on, only she hadn't.
Right, yeah. Right. And the family comes seeping, you know? Seeping through the cracks. Cracks branching violently through my equanimity.
But it's a wonderful image, because when somebody you have an emotional, real emotional connection with dies, they're with you constantly. So for her to put these people who were so pivotal in her life away, it's almost like she varnished the surface, mm-hmm. and it's cracking. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a hell of an image.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and they're not rushing in. They're kind of seeping in. I mean, you know, so I got the impression that she had constructed a really very big wall around herself.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. Right. And now the wall has cracked, but it hasn't crumbled.
Right.
Yet.
Although it's a violent crack.
Right.
Right.
When she said she wafted around for a moment outside of Earth's gravitational pull, I thought of heaven. I thought of where the dead people reside. And so for a moment, there they were, and then she's back to reality and has to think about them because they're coming in. I mean, that's outside Earth's gravitational pull. You know, where is she?
Right. What's the famous thing about the earthly coil? You know, shuffle off
the mortal coil.
The mortal, right, right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
Hamlet.
Right, Hamlet. So,
it's death.
It's what?
It's death. Right?
Yeah, death. Yeah. Right. So when the coil is what keeps you, you know. But I also got the sense. Did you get the sense that it made her jump up?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So it snapped. You know.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So. Okay. Let's keep going. Harriet?
I forgot where I was.
I picked up the phone.
Okay. I put it down. I picked it up. I put it down. I picked it up and dialed. And Jake answered on the first ring. Yes, he said wearily. Oh, Christ, I said, and hung up. I dialed again, and again he answered immediately.
"My cousin died," I said. "Your cousin?" "Cousin Maury, the violinist." "Did I ever meet him?" Jake said. "No," I said, "you never met him, though you once saw a letter he..." But wait. My heart started to thud around clumsily like a narcoleptic on a trampoline. "Why are we talking about you? This is about my cousin." I started to read. "Morris Sandler, violin virtuoso, dies at 66. Sandler was known as..." Keep going?
Yeah.
"At 66, Jake said. At 66, at 93, at 14, at 78, at 66 what? Those numbers just aren't the point, are they? Have you been drinking?" "I've been working. I'm at the lab. I'm sorry about your cousin. I didn't remember that you had one. You weren't close to him, were you?"
Okay. So this is, other than her memories and so on, what's the first thing that we learn about her? You know, she gets this fright about Maury's obit. Pick it up, put it down, pick it up, put it down, pick it up, put it down. And then he says yes, and she says, and she just hangs up on him. We see that a couple of times, right? Mm-hmm. She just, mm-hmm. you know.
Well, he said it wearily. It's like he was in pain. Yeah, what do you want? And yeah. I think that's why she hung up, because the sound of his voice wasn't...
Right.
Negative. Well, I think she hung up more because she wasn't sure if she really wanted to enter back into this relationship.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it was very, you know, do I want to do this? But who else am I going to call? Right. I have nobody else.
Right. Right. But he does answer the phone, and then he answers it again on the first ring. I mean, he may not be like thrilled to hear from her, but he, you know, the answering on the first ring means I'm willing to pick up. And I'm picking up, you know, I'm here for you in a certain extent. And then when at the end, we're going to go through the rest of it, but I hung up again, tossed the omelet in the trash, drank up my wine, poured myself another glass, flopped down on the couch as the ringing of the phone broke off. She had hung up again, you know, and so he had called her back, and she just leaves it. You know, there's something about her that's... She treats him awfully, you know, horribly.
She compartmentalizes a lot of things. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
She seems to have trouble with intimacy.
She has trouble, yes.
I wonder where she gets that from.
Couldn't tell.
Lois, do you want to keep going? I held the receiver away from me.
I held the receiver away from me and stared at it. He sighed. "Listen, do you want me to come by?" "No," I said, though I did want him to come by. Or I fiercely wanted him to come by, but only if he was going to be a slightly different person.
That's a great thing.
A person with whom I would be a different person. A pleasant, benign, even-tempered person. "I'm sorry I called again. I'm sorry I called again." "I wasn't being flippant," he said. "It just really suddenly struck me how primitive it is to measure the life of a human being by revolutions of moons and stars and planets. Anybody who still believes our species is the apex of creation should..." "How do you suggest we measure the life of a human being?" I said. "By weight? Would that be less primitive? By volume? By votes? By distance commuted? By lamentations? By beauty?" He sighed again.
Yeah, incredible. But back to this... I wanted him to come by, but only if he was going to be a different person and I was going to be a different person.
But so, I also think that, the back up a little bit, I think it's important when he's saying, "You weren't close to that cousin." And so that's very dismissive. Mm-hmm. And I know that, I mean, I that really resonated with me because I had an aunt and on my father's side, and my mom, you know, had sort of taken care of her, driven her everywhere for years. And she was a really nasty person, I mean, to be honest. And so when she died, my mother was terribly upset. And my sister said to her, "Why are you so upset? I mean, she really wasn't a nice person." And my mom just looked at her and said, "What are you talking about? You know, this is somebody who was in my life for over 60 years. What does being nice have to do with it?" You know, but I think that that's a really important thing. This was her last tie to any relative.
Right.
And that was the important point, not whether or not she's close.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. And But there's this theme of, in addition to the many things that go on between her and Jake, there's this theme of, you know, I want you to be the way I want you to be, not the way you are. I don't know if you remember from Your Duck is My Duck, mm-hmm. but no wonder I couldn't sleep. Who would allow themselves to go to sleep with all the stupid, rotting brain trash that would be waiting for you when you got there? How mortifying, how mortifying. And furthermore, Graham was right. If in fact I'd ever loved him, it was the Graham, his very email made it all too clear, of my own devising. Mm-hmm. You know, we create the people that we want, you know, we want them to be. And then when they're not what they want, what we want them to be, you know, that's when the trouble begins.
But she also wants herself to be different, too.
She does.
She's aware of that.
She has that, enough, a little bit of awareness. Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Right, right. Okay, but, and then, how do you suggest we measure the life of a human being? That's a great question, yeah. right? You know, it's like, and you can see what they had in common. You know, he immediately goes from, you know, 66. What does 66 mean? Years, you know, that's so, you know, how can we measure that way? It's so arbitrary and so on. You know, they have these intellectual discussions, like, you know, when they get back from the holiday and they're what are they? Or bacteria or something like that. They're fighting about it, and it doesn't matter that he's the researcher. And she doesn't know him. You know, they're enjoying. That's what they do. They, you know, they talk to each other in that way.
I do like the idea of measuring life by lamentation.
yeah.
That's very good.
yeah. By distance commuted, by votes, you know. Well, let's talk about those. How do you suggest we measure the life of a human being? By weight? What does that mean?
Yeah, you've ever been to a lot of children's funerals. I mean, what is almost invariably said is, oh, how small the casket was or how little it weighs, and they only had to have two pallbearers. I mean,
right.
people... absolutely measure.
Yeah.
By
yeah.
weight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Or whether you're fat or thin. If the standard is mm-hmm. thin.
Right. Right.
You know, look at their life. If they're heavy.
Right.
Look at it differently by weight.
Right. By volume.
How much
How much space they take up in the world.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Two great minds together.
Thank you.
What about by
I
votes?
I applaud that.
By votes.
But
how many people like you?
How
yeah.
many?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And what difference you have made to the world.
Well, that would be, that's getting into more, you know, of what we would hope, right? People measure, you know, the mm-hmm. impact of a life, mm-hmm. but we're not quite there yet.
Okay.
We got volume, we're still back, you know, how much space you take up, votes, popularity, right. is that how we should measure it? Distance commuted,
how
you know,
far you've come
like,
along.
Oh, yeah. right? Lamentations and beauty.
I'm just going
yeah.
to
call. Okay.
By lamentations, how many people mourned you? Is that what they mean?
It could be that.
I read it the other way.
Yeah, yeah, how much sorrow you had. Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. I was also thinking, I mean, lamentations makes it seem like it would be more like sorrow or something mm-hmm. that you've mm-hmm. suffered and so on. But I was also thinking about, you know, how much you complain.
Right.
You know, mm-hmm. possibly. Okay, he sighed again. Sorry, I said, I glanced around the room. Wendy?
The fading traces of Jake still floating starkly against his absence. I love you, we still said to each other, but after a year and more of separation, it seemed less and less likely that either of us would want him to move back in. And a vacuous, terminating, formal tone of apology clung to that word, love.
It was like a yellow police tape at a crime scene.
Jake? What, he said. What do you want me to do? I hung up again, tossed the omelet into the trash, drank up my wine to the accompaniment of the ringing phone, poured myself another glass. Friday night, why not? and flopped down on the couch with the newspaper as the ringing of the phone broke off.
Okay. So that was the first episode, and you'll notice that this story was divided, you know, they have those lines, right in between. So it's like, it's a long short story, but it has these little chapters. Just to notice. Okay, so now let's go to more of the relationship between the mother and the daughter. Judging from the photo, Elena?
You want me to keep going?
Or Wendy, yeah, go ahead. Go ahead, judging from the photo.
Judging from the photo, Mari, my only cousin, eventually came to look just like his mother, Adela. But as he seems to have had a wife at some point and was apparently a respected collector of original classical scores as well as a technically peerless musician, the resemblance, despite my mother's gloatingly doleful predictions, must not have demolished him entirely.
What is going to demolish him?
The way he looks.
It's the nose. It's the nose. He's got the Aunt Adela's nose. Okay, skip down to the next paragraph, the last five lines, in any event at some point.
What does that paragraph start with?
As it happens.
Under Mary Margaret. Mm-hmm. She's got a candle. Mm-hmm.
In any event, at some point, I commit the faux pas of announcing in the presence of both my mother and Aunt Adela that I will be marrying Mari when the time is right. Well, it's your life, my mother says, but don't blame me when your children turn out feeble-minded.
Okay, but this is in... Who's there in this conversation?
Aunt Adela is
the mother of this child.
Yes. How could she say that?
Well, because
she said
marry your cousin. Yeah. Because that's what happens when you marry your cousin. I mean, what may happen. Yeah.
Well, and the mother is endlessly positive about everything.
Yeah, right. So, yeah. Right. And so part of it is the genetic thing, but part of it is because Adela's response is, oh, that reminds me, did I forget Mari's graduating summa? You know, because she's casting aspersion on Mari. Right. Mari's not up to what you should be and so on. My aunt says distractedly to my mother, snorts, you did not forget. So now keep going. Later when we are alone,
my mother adds, that in civilized parts of our country, only criminals marry their cousins. And furthermore, she expects me to do better than someone in that family. Despite Adela's boasting, she says, despite the grades and honors, Mori has an exceptionally mediocre mind. It would be a miracle if he did not graduate summa from the 10th-rate college he is attending. The only reason he gets all those good grades in the first place is because he's able to memorize a freakish number of pointless facts. Naturally, Adela finds this remarkable, so she can't even remember where she put her head. As she cannot remember even where she put her head. I expect you to outshine Mori by far, my mother says. You have much more to offer, much more. Your problem is that you don't apply yourself. Mori's capacious but unnuanced memory was acquired from his father, who was so rigid himself that he toppled over and died at the age of 40, my mother tells me. Her impersonally disapproving gaze is directed as she speaks at a pair of stockings she's inspecting for runs. And remember, she says, marry in haste, repent in leisure.
Okay.
She's the queen of put downs.
But she's brilliant at it. Oh my God! I mean, in a sick way, you know. She's
Joan Rivers.
She's amazing. Mm-hmm. You know, every single one of them is like sharp and incredible. You know, the father who's so rigid, he toppled over.
Yeah, you know, I saw that in my mind.
You know, he decided to topple over and die, you know, because he's so rigid. Okay.
She doesn't have a sharp nose, only a sharp tongue.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, she's, yeah, yeah. She's
and it's
really
interesting that the put-downs are not just for her daughter. She doesn't care who's around.
No. It doesn't
everybody.
Bother me.
It's everybody, right. Except her own parents.
Right.
My poor father's passage over. We'll see it in a little bit. Okay. Right. Okay. My aunts are the frequent topic.
My aunts are the frequent topic of discourse when I visit my mother in her bedroom, where she sits in her big chair, her feet in a basin of water cloudy with salts and potions. The feet are lumpy, whirled, fish white, and riveting. Crow's feet, the toenails thick and yellow, mottled with blue. A fungus, she says. Blue and red grass of her suffering run up and down her sooty legs, which has her hiked-up dressing gown exposes all the way to the thighs.
You can picture those toes.
To.
It's unbelievable.
Right.
And what are the blue and red grafts?
The veins.
The veins, yes, yes. Okay. A slice of cucumber.
A slice of cucumber sits over each of my mother's closed eyes to reduce puffiness. And as she talks, I concentrate on spreading out my substance, making myself spongy to absorb the pussiness into myself, to absorb the pain radiating through her feet and legs and back. She works nights in the cloakroom of the club, standing all the time. And that's what accounts for the conspicuous veins that I find so fascinating, but which she explains to me are disfiguring.
Okay, so what's happening here?
So we get an idea that her mother does not have the most prestigious job,
right?
And yet she's putting down other people who are academically more accomplished.
Yeah. So right. So she has a job in a cloakroom, mm-hmm. right? And but what is the daughter trying to do
she's
here?
Trying to take care of her pain. Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's like, you know,
she wants to suck it all up as a sponge. She wants to do whatever she can, and
right.
no matter what we and know, why, no matter
and,
what she
and
does.
And why does she want to do that?
She wants to be the good girl that the mother
She's
loves.
A child. You know?
She wants to rescue her mother.
Right.
And her mother, of the many gifts that the mother gives this daughter, one is the gift of guilt. Why am I standing up all day in the cloakroom? So that you can go to college, mm-hmm. right? So, you know, a child's instinct is to want to rescue the parent anyway. But even if she didn't come up with the idea herself, her mother, you know, tells her, you know, these grafts running up my legs, mm-hmm. you. You know, in case we didn't, in case this kid wasn't bearing enough burden. And yet, there's an intimacy there. I visit my mother in her bedroom. And, the amazing thing about this depiction of the mother-daughter relationship is it's mostly horrific, but there are moments. What are the moments? They're very few and far between, mm-hmm. but they are. Where do we?
Well, you know, from my feeling, a child loves the mother, and thinks that that's the way mothers are. She doesn't realize as a young child that her mother is nasty. Takes her a little while to catch up.
Yes, and she looks at the veins. My mother explains to me mm-hmm. that they're disfiguring. Yeah. They don't look disfiguring
right.
to her.
Right.
They look, you know, they're yeah, really right. interesting. So turn to 81, and on the third paragraph, when we finally get home, my mother and I shake ourselves out. She's been in the cloakroom the entire day or the entire whatever the shift is mm-hmm. with her mother, going crazy mm-hmm. with boredom. I shake ourselves out and imitate the men we've seen that day, strutting and braying until I get the hiccups from laughing, and then my mother makes me hot milk with honey in it so I can fall asleep. You know, I mean, So they're sharing, right? Making fun of the men. Mm-hmm. And her mother made, you know, that's milk and honey.
Right.
You know, this is the nurturing mother. You know, and so we have this one moment, and then there's one other moment, which is go back to 79. You know, after all of the last paragraph, it's hard to believe, but there is the evidence, always building to the same ringing summation, meaning, my mother tells me this all the time, a lack of advantages ate the lovely girl alive. Who's the lovely girl? It's the picture on the dresser, right? Of her, of the mother, not of the daughter, right? It's the picture of her. A lack of advantages ate the lovely girl alive. That's the explanation for all of her mother's troubles. In other words, it happened to me. It happened to me. You know, the world did this to me. You know, this is, I had a friend once, you know, it was always what the world did to him. You know, it was always what the world did to him. He's the victim, the victim. And so that's what her mother is telling her. Ate the lovely girl, emitted in her place someone shaped like a melting pyramid on which is balanced a head as wide and oval as my aunt's heads are long and oval, adorned with the ends of with little frilly ears, topped now with a careful display of durable looking reddish curls, someone whose feet must sit in a basin. I reach for my mother's hand. So here's the rescue again, right? She's giving her the hand. What's the matter with you, she says, but she allows my hand to stay clasped around her fingers, even though it is clammy and disagreeable. Who's clammy and disagreeable?
The daughter.
She allows me to clasp her hand, even though my hand, she's doing me a favor by not like throwing my hand away when I, you know, and so, The way that the daughter describes this, her mother has given her a gift. Allows me to clasp her hand. Mm-hmm. That's actually another, you know, I mean, when you hear it, it doesn't sound good, but when you think of you know, the perspective that this child has it on it, her mother has been kind to her, has given her a gift in a really messed up way. Flower to fruit to bare branch. Sun to wan star. Sun, my mother, wan star, me. Mm-hmm. Who am I to complain? The laws are the laws. I shake my head and clear away for my answer. Nothing. You know, what's the matter with you? You don't have any reason to be upset. It's me who's bearing the burdens of the world, is the mother's message. Your cousin Maury was a beautiful child. My first thought when I saw him with Adela was to wonder if he wasn't adopted. She's brilliant. No one in the family need worry about being loved for beauty alone. It's a killer. My mother says, impressing upon me the power of euphemism. What is the power of euphemism?
Is it sarcasm?
Yeah, so here is a euphemism for what for nastiness. Mm-hmm. It's called euphemism. Mm-hmm. In other words, the power of euphemism, the mother is being totally nasty. Yeah. The kid has been sold a bill of goods to say that this is a euphemism. No one in the family need worry about being loved for beauty alone. In fact, my aunts with their coarse black hair, narrow faces, huge vivid features, and long legs extending elegantly from their bell-shaped furs look nothing like the other people in our little city. The Polacks and the Litvaks, my mother calls them. she's amazing. Okay, now, then her mother refuses to take her to see aliens. How did she come to see the aliens?
Maury
tells her later when he writes back, he says, I remember taking you to a movie about extraterrestrials that seemed to make a big impact on you. Yes, it did, but not one that her mother would support, right? Yeah. page 80. What is certain, okay, so now, no, that's not where I want to go. The euphemism, as a euphemism, okay. Let's skip to 90, well, just one more thing on 81. Fortunately, my mother continues, beauty is not the only thing in life, although she's obsessed with it, right? Your Aunt Bernice and your Aunt Adela are honest and hardworking, but we have to be grateful because they've taken trouble over you. Your Aunt Charna has some style, at least. That one wouldn't be half so homely if only she'd do something about the nose. She looks sharply at me and then sighs. You know, it's like... okay, so she looks at my, so the daughter knows that she has a terrible nose, according to her mother, and that she's not pretty. Let's go to 93, just for a minute, and then we'll come back. She's at church with Mary Margaret, right? Why does she go to church?
Because Mary Margaret's her girlfriend, and she goes to church, so she goes with her.
Well, it's partly to be with
accepted.
Mary Margaret.
Yeah. She gets, feels accepted.
She feels accepted. That's where God is. Okay. God is at church, and God can take the pain away from her mother, right? So still, it's not too hard to sidle. I love this. And then sometimes Mary Margaret agrees to take me to church, though she won't let me get up to take communion with her because I'm not in a state of grace. I'm afraid to ask why not. I can guess. It's because I haven't washed well enough.
I have to tell you something real funny. My uncle married a Polish woman who had a child, and that was my cousin. And my cousin, I would sleep over at their house, and my cousin would go to church. And I said, well, I don't know what to do in a church. She said, well, just do whatever I do. So we did everything, whatever, and went up front, and they put this thing. I turned to her, I said, boy, they are lousy cookies. That's what this reminded me.
That's great. Right, so... it's because but even if I've washed and washed, I don't protest because I'm more afraid of violating a rule in the lofty, solemn place full of God's echoes and perfume and fleeting colors than I am even of stepping on a crack in the sidewalk and breaking my mother's back. Whether or not to tell Mary Margaret has been weighing on me for some time. And then she tells her she's the Jews. I already knew it. My father calls you and your mother the Jews. Are my mother and my aunts and my cousin and I going to hell? Cross your heart. We stare at each other in consternation. And then she nods. But maybe if I bring you to church with me enough, we can get your term reduced. I get Aunt Bernice to clarify whether or not... you know, and then they go to High Holy Days, but nobody believes in God. You know, it's so perfectly typical. So, but she's going to church because she says that maybe if I open myself up, God's dragon breath will purify my impurities. You know, the idea of a child thinking that she has these impurities, you know, we know where that came from, and take away and answer my prayer that I ask, which is to take away my mother's pain. It's so heartbreaking in so many ways, you know, that she's so so upset about her mother's pain. You know, the total empathy, the total identification there with the mother. And the idea that she has impurities, you know, and
you know, each part of this reminds me of a pile driver. And every time the mother does something, she knocks this child down further and further to have no feeling of self-worth.
Oh, it's terrible. Mm-hmm. It's horrible. So when she's, by the time she's, you know, in elementary school, she knows she's, you know, she knows she has this nose. Then when she gets into middle school, you know, she is, she's told that she does, or when it's, she gets into high school, mm-hmm. I start to do everything wrong. Mm-hmm. Why are you wearing that thing? I mean, it's like a perfectly phrased for people who describe their mothers criticizing their clothes. I don't know how, you've heard it exactly in those words. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're wearing that, mm-hmm. You know, and then, you know, and then when a boy says hello to her, you know, she understand, her mother has to tell her that she's not one of the pretty girls, and, you know, just, you know, that they won't even run for cover when, you know, when she falls in love for her. For who she is, according to her mother, is just for what men feel the world owes them. It is, you know, what Ina was saying, after, you know, at every stage of her development, her mother is, you know, just shatters her, really. And it's so painful. Okay, ran out of time. We'll continue with the mother-daughter relationship. Plus, we'll do memory. So, why don't you reread it? We can read the next story too, but reread this, and we'll finish it up next time. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Okay.
Oh.
Like, don't you feel like after this you have to choose your words wisely?
Oh my God.